Hello.
Hi.
Are we recording?
Sure.
Are we actually recording? Are we good?
Yeah, sure.
Why not? Okay. All right. Hi, Derek.
Don't. No.
Hi, Sean.
Different times.
Okay, you go first.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Sean and Derek.
We're joined by Richard Schneeman. Let's see. You work for Heroku on the Ruby build pack.
Yeah.
You are a Rails committer?
Yeah. Yes. I have commit bit to Rails.
Yeah.
Also a professor?
I was an adjunct professor for the University of Texas at one point in time. They gave me an access card to buildings and students, and I got to make, like, grade papers.
Did they call you professor?
It's pretty exciting. Yes, until they realized that... I was prepared for, like, the how old are you question, and I was like, I'm totally going to lie about this. And then one of them was like, hey, so when did you graduate from undergrad? And then we realized that, like, some of them were older than me. But it was a great group, and it worked out pretty well.
Well, you look good in a lab coat, so, I mean, that's all you need, right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you gave a talk at this conference on making things fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like fast things.
Right.
I have a mechanical engineering degree.
And it must have felt good because people got kicked out of the room because it was so full.
Like me.
Like Sean.
Yes, yes. They had to run a garbage collection iteration over the room. There were no empty slots, and we were memory bound. We had to swap. People were going in and out of the room. That's how that worked. Am I like straining this analogy too far?
Can
we go a little bit further?
Sure, whatever.
No, I'm done. It's like fitting RSS in there somewhere.
Emacs, 8 megabytes and constantly swapping.
Mm.
8 mega audiences and no.
Okay, all right, we're done with this now.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
But the talk went really, really well. I got a lot of really good feedback from it. I'm really interested in memory use, basically. Heroku, we sell by the memory size, and I have people who say, like, hey, I'd like to get more, you know, like, I'd like to run my app, but I'm running out of memory. And
right.
Wouldn't it be amazing if a lot of the gems that we use all the time, like, use less memory? And
so would it be fair to say that, in general, apps on Heroku tend to be memory-bound and not CPU-bound?
I think most Ruby apps are. That would be okay. my best. I do like benchmarking things. And so if I could come up with an accurate, reliable benchmark to prove that to you, I totally would. But I'm just going to go with my gut and say yes.
So you've had a couple of interesting commits, right? So what was it? We removed the Raggle state machine from the mail gem?
The mail gem is capable of parsing incoming email, though most people don't use it. And what happened, it was using a parser called Treetop. And Treetop is great, but it was a little slow. And somebody came in, they volunteered to use the Raggle parser, and it sped it up by a tremendous amount, just blowing metrics out of the water. Unfortunately, when they did this, the code that they introduced was much, much larger. So it added about, I wish I had my slides right in front of me. It maybe like 20 megabytes, I think.
That 20, sounds familiar.
About 20 megabytes of overhead just to add this parser that most people aren't using.
Right.
Most people aren't parsing email unless you're... I don't know, MailChimp or something.
Accepting inbound email, basically.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Well, and then, like, even does Griddler actually use the MailGem to do the parsing? Do you know?
I'm not Caleb. I don't know.
Okay, we'll ask Caleb.
Let's call Caleb.
Caleb. We'll use our phone a friend. Hang on.
Yeah.
And then
50-50?
Well, and then it's already 50-50.
It is a yes or no question.
So it would be perfect. It would eliminate it. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then what? So right now you're working on reducing the amount of things loaded by the MIME types gem?
Yeah. So a lot of people don't realize, but MIME types is required by everything in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
And it takes up, right now it takes up about 20 megs. So it's like 20 megs seems to be a really popular number.
How do you store MIME types and take up 20 megs of RAM? Like how does this happen?
So what the MIME type gem does is if you're not familiar, MIME types would store like content types, so like application HTML and like common file extensions like .html, and you could do something like say, hey, somebody is sending me something with, you know, a .html, like what type of a header should I put on this? What type of a content type should I put on this? Mm-hmm. And so the MIME types gem is just basically a giant blob of a ton of that information, about 1,879
sounds something like that.
Of those, and then it gets read in at boot time, and then we generate 1,800 and a lot of objects, and then those are retained in memory and never ever released. So,
and then in Rails proper, right? Literally, the only thing we ever use it for is this request JSON.
Exactly. So, yeah, in a lot of places, you only need, like, one or two or three, but yet we have to keep everything in memory.
So is that what's in Rails, is that what's driving those, like, when I do those format blocks, when I say, like, or is that actually the, that is actually the extension on the request, isn't it?
It depends.
Yeah, well, so it, in order to do things like, I think carrier wave, if you're doing, like, file uploads and you're accepting a bunch of different things and you're storing them in S3, it's like, I want to be able to say if I'm storing like a JPEG, then whenever I serve it, I can serve it with the right content type so that the browser says, "Oh, this is a JPEG," and I know how to render a JPEG, and it'll do the right thing, as opposed to just being like, "Here's a binary blob," that it's like, I don't know what this is.
And then we do the reverse too in the controller layer, right? So if you are using an accept header instead of an explicit extension, we'll use the same gem to say like, okay, what is the actual, basically, is this JSON?
Yeah.
Does this accept header mean JSON?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you can do like the JSON or .xml,
right.
And like .html if you really want to get crazy.
So how do you make it take less memory?
That is a great question. if you would tell me, then I could just go and implement it. And now we have a bunch of ideas. One of them, what I'm currently working on right now, is storing the same amount of data, but in a much, much smaller object. And then doing kind of a lazy load where we do the exact same lookup, but then whenever we actually find something and we say, yes, we're going to use this, then we promote it into the slightly more heavyweight MIME-type object. So that's one way. The actual JSON parsing and loading is potentially taking up a lot of memory, so I've been playing around with a bunch of different ways to do that. If I had already done this successfully, then I could totally answer your question.
That's great. It's good to hear ideas.
Yeah, I was... I was just talking with Jeremy from the author of SQL, just got the Ruby Hero Award, and he's actually got a patch into the mail gem, which also uses MIME types. Everything, it's like with the mail gem for some reason. and to actually just remove it totally and use a very lightweight implementation instead. But, like, the problem is everything has trade-offs, right? Like, mm-hmm. Everything has, like, pros and cons, and we don't want to sacrifice speed, but we also don't want to use so much memory, like... So, yeah, there's a lot of benchmarking, trial and error, a lot of scientific process, which is what my talk was on. Not trial and error.
We don't like science.
It's all scientific trial and error.
We don't like science.
Well, it is a little bit like, I mean, it definitely is. It's maybe not like formally the scientific method, right? But like, but it is important. Like, I think we, even making small adjustments in our apps for performance, like, we guess a lot, mm-hmm. rather than measuring.
Oh, totally.
And we're like, this will be faster. And some things, you know, right? You're like, this is an N+1 query. Guess what? If I do include, it's going to be faster. Like,
exactly.
That's because somebody has already done the science for you,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty obvious then anyway.
Yeah, it's a known. It's right. Like in math, where it's like, this theorem is like proven, therefore.
Right. Sure. But there are many times where we're just like, maybe I'm allocating too many objects. Let's just do this and see if, and like, it's a bunch of work, and then you commit it, and you're like, well, it was not any better.
Yeah.
Or like, you had an example where you were like, great, I'm just going to do this, and it's going to be so much better, and I can't remember the specific example, and then it turned out it was slower. It was like ratcheting up the number of sidekick
mm-hmm.
workers,
mm-hmm.
or whatever they call them, right?
Yeah, I was working on something. I thought it was CPU bound, and so I doubled the number of threads, and it turns out it was not CPU bound, that actually made it slower.
Right.
and it's just like, wait a second, this more of these things are like better. It's like a kid who gets like a candy bar, and it's like, one candy bar is great, ten must be like even better, and then they're just like, my stomach hurts.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting to me that like we're in a position now, like, I don't know, when I was doing development first, like 10 years ago for companies, like, we had these big beefy servers and memory didn't matter. I feel like memory didn't matter as much. And now we've swung back to having more smaller servers where memory matters a lot more. Is that, am I wrong about this feeling of how things were going? Like, we used to buy these giant beefy servers to serve like some silly little ASP website.
Were you running Ruby on those servers?
No, we were running ASP.
Ruby.ASP? Is that?
No, that's what I mean. Like, I think that's a big part of it, right? Is that we actually just are consuming more memory because we're using these higher level languages that aren't necessarily built to not use a lot of memory.
But like, what's my memory on a 1x Heroku box?
It's the same as it was when we first started. It's 512 megabytes of RAM.
Right, and that's no way. Like, these servers we were buying had, like, gigabytes of RAM, right?
Yeah, So I think one of the big things that's changed is the paradigm of how people want to develop.
Right.
Heroku started becoming polyglot, like, right before I started working for them. And it was really difficult getting Java developers to use Heroku because all Java developers are used to, you know, having a box with this huge amount of RAM, and just like, it's just like, oh, we need more performance, more cores, more RAM, more disk, and it's just only vertical, like they only ever vertically scale, and a lot of the default frameworks and everything actually expect, they have like sticky sessions where they expect to be hitting the same box, versus Ruby doesn't vertically scale that well. Like, I mean, we can do processes, and there are unicorns and stuff like that, but it actually, kind of from the beginning, it made more sense to, like, we were almost in the CGI sort of mindset where we're like, hey, we want a lot of really small processes. And I think actually the entire industry is now moving around to more like small disposable containers that it's like, oh, if we want to scale, like we want to be, you know, people can't see this right now, I'm doing air quotes, web scale. but, you know, that means many multiple servers as opposed to, at one point in time, it's like you're going to run out of RAM expansion slots.
Yep.
Yeah.
And different languages can take advantage of those things in different ways. Like, I think Ruby is explicitly well suited to many instances across kind of a horizontal scaling pattern.
And it's also like when you do get into that situation where you're like, well, I'm out of RAM on this box, so I need to buy another box. And it's like, well, here's $10,000
more. Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and like,
exactly.
And then all of a sudden the site is not as important and you have these three $10,000 servers that are sitting there. And you're like, well.
Oops. And 10 months signing contracts, and then they actually get installed. Yeah.
So I think even outside of Ruby, like you were saying, people are starting to realize that like that's an expensive way to scale and we can do this a little more if we're willing to make trade-offs, like everything we mentioned mm-hmm. is a trade-off, right?
Well, and you also used to be able to just be like, let's Moore's Law it out, right? Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't think that's really an option anymore. Doing that's a lot more expensive than it used to be.
Totally. Yeah, just in general, one of the things I think actually cloud computing has changed the paradigm where a lot of people are actually thinking more of the resources that they need to use. And they, like previously, like you said, it's like you just buy the biggest box you can, but, and you find ways to try and use it. And like, and now it's you, there is an actual direct cost with that. And if you're a super small startup or you're the pre-startup phase and you're working on something, it's like, obviously you want to be able to run on like the free Heroku tier, or the $5 DigitalOcean or the, you know, AWS promotional thing. And I do think that actually drives some of the desire to run smaller and more agile. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, clearly things that benefit apps that run on Heroku is a big focus for you. I remember the first time you and I actually started interacting was you asked for somebody to volunteer to pair with you, and we deprecated path helpers in mailers.
Yes. I love email. You can tell. So, I mean, I do a bunch of work with students, and also just in my own work, I was sending out emails, and for a week, I was sending out all these emails with links that just didn't work because they were relative URLs. And it wasn't until somebody like took the time to like find me on Twitter and like be like, "Hey, my emails don't work," and I'm like, "What are you talking about? Like, I'm sending out emails," and then like I had to look up the thing and be like, "Oh." So, like, in addition to performance, one of my – I call it, like, the 10,000 paper cuts. It's just, like, of a developer. Like, you run into all of these errors and these exceptions, and some of them hurt more than others. And some of them, it's like you get the paper cut, and you don't even know you got the paper cut until, like, the next week or the next month. And those are the ones that really hurt.
Right. Whoops, it works.
You've already sent out 10,000 of these emails that have relative links in them that
yeah.
nobody can click on anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I like, mean, you even tested them, and you were like, this thing should have a link, too, and you used your path helper there.
Yep, exactly.
And you're like, look at the test pass. What are you talking about? There's definitely a link here.
Yeah, and you get the email, and the links show up like in blue or whatever. Yep. And it's like, and you're not going to click on every link on every single. Yeah, no. So I this was a kind of a fail fast sort of a thing where it's like, yeah, let's you know, these shouldn't work,
right?
Like you shouldn't be allowed to do the wrong thing. It's like
no case in which you want a path in an email.
So we got some pushback.
Okay, never mind.
I feel like the people who were pushing back were wrong, and the people who were doing the examples that were given was like, if you actually put the root URL manually, and then you want to put the path after it, but it's just like, don't do that.
But you can pass host to the
URL helper, yeah.
Yeah, so that actually ended up being what was our saving grace, is there was still an out.
Right.
If you still wanted to manually specify this. But yeah, so I will say dealing with Rails and also dealing with Heroku, like anytime you're like, oh, it's an edge case, and it's like just the sheer number of people who use, you know, both our service and who use Rails, it's like I guarantee you there are you're probably hitting thousands of those edge cases like per hour.
Yeah. Every change breaks somebody's workflow.
Yes. Yeah. Right. It's like no matter how wrong that workflow is.
Right. Spacebar overheating. We'll link to the XKCD in the show notes.
Totally.
Let's take a quick break to tell you about our sponsor this week. It's Code School. Code School is an online platform for learning different languages and technologies. They've got everything. So if you're already a Ruby on Rails developer, what can you get out of this, right? So I work with a lot of Ruby on Rails developers, and myself also can use a lot of brush up on SQL skills. So if I go to Code School today, I'm going to find a couple different courses on SQL, and the second one especially gets into a lot of more advanced topics like how to do aggregate functions and things like that. So if you need to brush up on your SQL skills, for instance, Code School is something excellent to check out. They have lots of different things, not just SQL. They've got design and development courses as well. I was just talking with some coworkers over lunch about what they like about Code School, and they all universally said that all of the lessons were fun. So each one has a nice theme that's really kind of lightens the mood and brings you into it. They all have jingles, which are very delightful. And also, if you just find yourself like on the train or with some time to kill somewhere, they've got a free iPhone and iPad app that you can use to interact with Code School on the go. And this month, Code School has given us a bunch of free one-month subscriptions to give out to you all. So if you want to be eligible for one of those subscriptions, you can leave us a review on iTunes, and we'll randomly select a few people throughout the month and distribute them to you that way. Thanks again to Code School for sponsoring this episode. One thing I wanted to talk about was, as I was preparing my talk, which was on code review,
mm-hmm.
I talked to like Caleb and a couple other people, and I was like, can you send me some good open source commits? And by that I meant like not like what changed, but like excellent like descriptions, a lot of context, right?
Mm.
And I think Caleb linked me to like five of yours. So like
awesome, the bribes have been working. Okay.
We actually have Caleb and me and John Urich at ThoughtBot actually have like, we've talked about doing this, but we don't actually do it, as like commit of the month or commit of the week, where we just like try to one up each other, or we find ones online that are really good where it's like, look at all the effort I put into the message in this commit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's super important. I don't know where I was going with this, but like obviously you value it as well, and like,
yeah, so I work remotely, and also all of my interactions with open source maintainers, and anytime I've tried to, like, I'm an oversharer. Like I just, when I talk with people, like I want to like over communicate. I really want them to know where I'm like coming from, and it like super stresses me out when somebody is like, hey, this thing didn't work, and I'm like, tell me more. I want to know. I want to understand. And I spent a bunch of time reading open source issues. I've got this thing I'll totally plug in like 2 seconds. And a lot of the issues, like I felt like I was a pretty good programmer, but I just didn't understand the issues. And I'd get this pull request, and I can read through the code, but I'm like, what? I'm missing the context, and what is even going on? And it was just so frustrating. So I wanted to have anybody who's reading my pull request, hopefully it's like if it's a bug, say what used to happen and what happens now, what you expected and what you want to happen. It's like, if it's performance, like what was the performance before, what's the performance now? Like you are submitting a code change, so like let's provide the like mental model of what changed as well.
Well, because if you write your code well, right, your code should very clearly say what it's doing. You should never need a comment that's saying, like, this code does X. The code should describe itself. But then you do oftentimes lose the why.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put it in a comment, but if you put it in a comment, comments and code have a tendency to get out of sync, right? And the context changes. But commit messages have this beautiful thing where they're linked to a piece of code at a specific point in time. And then you get back there via blame later, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I almost think of it as like an argument of like, hey, I wrote some code. I think you should maintain it. And here's my argument for why you should maintain it.
Right. Yeah.
It's also like a good moment for like you said, like I get really excited about like a change. If I'm getting really excited about a change I made, like I want to let you know everything that was going through my head when I was making this change so that you're as excited about it as I am.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Totally.
Like,
absolutely.
Like trying to get somebody to maintain the code you wrote, or even just like a teammate being like, look what I learned. Or maybe like you're like, oh, I know they don't know this. I'm going to teach them this, right? This will be great. And you're like writing out this big thing, and like now it's documented for everybody else, like we talked about. So I think that's super important.
And it's documented for you too. Like,
right.
I've gone back to my old pull requests and pulled out benchmarks or code snippets that we used, or it's like, wait, why did we do that?
Right.
Yeah, no, I have to explain this to the Turing schoolers all the time when we're explaining like stuff that you do for the benefit of other people. Mm. And they're like, oh, but I have to do this when I'm just on a project by myself. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. Other people includes you next week, because you won't remember what the heck you were thinking.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing I could highly recommend to people interested in better code comments and better pull requests is better issues. It's a little service I wrote called CodeTriage.com.
CodeTriage.com.
CodeTriage.com is it's this open source app that I wrote, and you go to CodeTriage.com/Rails/Rails, and it'll send you one Rails issue a day, and it's like gift wrapped for you. Take a look at it and like, you know, see what other people are talking about. Eventually you can engage and like actually start helping out, and it's a great, really lightweight way to get involved. Also, new and improved, I have another service called DocsDoctor.org.
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 So who's the target audience of CodeTriage.com, and who is the target audience of DocsDoctor.org?
Developers.
Everybody. Okay. So every single person should be going to CodeTriage.com, yes, and DocsDoctor.org.
Obvious. Well, so I think...
So what does DocsDoctor do?
It's instead of an open source issue, it sends you either a documented or undocumented method in the library of your choice. So if you're like, hey, I'd like to learn more about the methods in Rails or Rack or Ruby, it'll send you, you can choose, I want documented methods. Or if you're like, man, I want some really easy, free, almost free commits, it's like, send me undocumented methods. And then the maintainers would be like, wow, thank you very much for this. And then in the process, like, I actually love documenting code that I didn't write, because that's when it's like, and adding examples and stuff, and either I learn a bunch about it right then, or like I submit it and they're like, yeah, this example is totally wrong, and then I learn about it, right, you know, and then it's a conversation. So I would say CodeTriage, if you don't know where to get started in open source, and you want to just like join, kind of test the waters and just see what people are talking about and how people talk and like the language, and just like, it's almost like if you've never been to a party ever before, it's, you get to stand in the shadows and you don't have to be out in the spotlight and be like, oh, okay, you know, this is, people are moving in this kind of funny way rhythmically to music. And then, you know, eventually one day, like, you can go out there and like bust out your moves and feel a little bit more confident. With DocsDoctor, I think it's probably some people who are already relatively comfortable with issues who don't know where to actually start contributing, like directly contributing code. And like, I think docs are something in Ruby that we are undervaluing. Or not undervaluing, it's just not...
That's not just Ruby.
Well, yeah, so it's interesting because I work with a bunch of other language people at Heroku, and... in Python, tests are kind of a thing in Python, but not nearly as big as in Ruby. In Ruby, it's like, you do not ship until you have tests. Like, if it's a library, like, I look at the tests, I run the tests. Like, tests are royalty, basically. And in Python, it's all about docs. How documented is your project? And I was like, wow, it'd be great if the docs in Ruby were, like, as good as the docs in Python. And that was actually my original motivator for, like, how would we ever play catch-up? you know, how would we ever, like, get to that point? It's like, because people are already so used to just, you go into this library and there's not docs on any of the other methods. If you contribute a new method, why would you write docs for it?
Right.
And it's like, oh, well, maybe if people could go back and, like, they're already looking. It's like people, so many people come up to me and they're like, I just want one commit in Rails. That's it. And then I'm done. I'm going to drop the mic. And it's like, please, you know, do that. And it's valuable. And you'll also, it's kind of like, it's like the gateway drug. It's like, you'll be like, that felt awesome. And like, I just, I loved it. And I want more. And anyway,
you clearly it shows that you care a lot about the community of open source. I remember one thing that really stood out, because we get a ton of issues per day on Rails. And it's usually the people who are responding, me, Raphael, and Matthew. And we're all really strained for time. So especially when we get the person who should have been on Stack Overflow, you know, we'll just be like, this should have gone on Stack Overflow, close. And that can come off as really, you know, it can come off as angry. And we don't mean it that way, but it's just like we're you know, we have to go through so many of these that we just, like, close them really fast. And I remember for a little while I was watching the issues that you would close, and you would give this really, really thoughtfully well-worded, like, hey, thanks a lot for opening this issue. Unfortunately, the issues tracker, we reserve it only for bugs, and that's, like, something that used to work in 4.1 but is broken in 4.2. Here's, and you would include links, and, like, you clearly put a lot of thought into this, but it makes a difference.
It's also why I didn't comment on nearly as many issues.
You need text expanders.
Yeah, totally. But I do think I still feel bad to this day, like, closing somebody else's pull request.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I do want that, like, people need to understand, it's like a closed pull request is not like a net zero sum game. Like, you learn so much about the library, and, you know, like, hopefully you learned why it was closed, and you learned some, you know, some history and some things there, and it'll help you so much more the next time. And just having more people who do those types of things and say why this thing is closed, or the biggest thing for me with, like, bug reports on Rails is just even responding and being like, can you tell me the versions that you're using?
Right.
Is like, it takes a non-trivial amount of time.
Yeah, no, and then especially getting them to use the bug report template, which is really, really important, that we either have a report using the bug report template or a sample app that replicates the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, we talked to Godfrey, and he mentioned those bug report templates, and I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, and they're in the we have a section of our contributing guide, which is just how to report a bug to Rails, but nobody reads it.
Well, the contributing guide is massive. There needs to be some, like, EULA or something like that. You have to, like, scroll to the bottom and, like, complete a quiz or something.
Yeah. We need to move the bug reporting section just to contributing.md, because at the very least, GitHub gives you, if you have that, it gives you the big yellow thing, like, please read this before opening an issue. Nobody's going
to
read it, but it's at least then we have
something
an excuse. At least then we can say, like, it's in this really accessible place, and you had a pop up saying please read it, as opposed to right now you have an excuse to not read it, because why would you know it exists, and why would you want to go through such a huge document to open a bug report?
The really weird thing to me about those types of issues, and I've done it before, where you don't realize you're giving incomplete information, and you're like, oh, I didn't realize that was important to this.
Mm-hmm.
But there are times when it's just like, I tried this and I got an error, and it's like, you're a developer. You understand how frustrating it is when your users come to you and you're like, I tried this and I got an error.
Yeah. No, it's like open issue doesn't work. What?
Right. We get those all day. Like, all you can do is roll your, like, what do you mean? What browser were you using? What record were you operating on when this happened? Like, give me as much information as you possibly have and I'll be able to help you. But it's really frustrating. It's surprising to me. It happens a lot when developers do that, because it's one of our chief problems, I think, like, one that we face.
And that's what we ask for, right, in Rails, is describe your issue in the form of a failing test case.
Yeah, no, and like, I think GitHub makes it really easy to do stuff like that, and services like Heroku. And I'm also interested in tooling of, like, so these really common problems on, like, large open source projects. It's like, nobody gets paid full-time to work on issues in Rails, so it's like, well, you know, maybe...
Someone used to.
on issues.
Just issues.
Oh, well,
you'll notice
full time on issues.
If you graph the issue count, you'll see it stayed steady for like 2 months while I was full time, and now it's going back up again.
Also, issues should totally be part of, like, the GitHub, like, graph thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Mine would be way more active, but I was totally going to say something.
I'm sorry.
No, it's so I would actually be interested in, it's like, in, like, maybe some more bot type things. Like, for a while, Raphael, who does a bunch of work with issues, like wrote kind of this little script that went and just like said, oh, all issues that are older than X that haven't, nobody said anything. It's like, just leave a comment and be like, is this still an open issue? And then like whoever did not leave a comment within the next week, just wrote another bot that went and closed all of them. Yeah. And it's like, maybe it makes sense if somebody opens up an issue that is not a pull request to just have a bot just comment on it and be like, hey, by the way, here's our bug report template.
It's really annoying, though. Like, if you want to see why I think I would disagree with this, go submit a pull request to AngularJS.
Yeah?
Because they have bots, just because they did try to automate this, and it's just you have to jump through so many hoops.
Huh.
And for whatever reason, I feel like having a bot tell you the hoops that you have to jump through is also just a bit, like, it feels more frustrating than having a human interaction. And we could probably, just fix it by having text expanders.
But no, what if the bot was simply like, it wasn't saying you have to do this, it was just saying, like, you know, like when you send an email to a company, it's like, you can expect to hear back from us and whatever, right? Instead of doing that, so what it would be was like, we've, you know, here's your issue, we have, you know, volunteers look at these issues, we'll try to get around to them, we'll respond to you, you know, to increase the value of the response you're going to get, like, make sure your issue includes these things, right? So we're not trying to see if they did include it, we're just reminding them of the types of things that should be included in an issue.
Yeah, I mean,
like what they're getting out of the contributor's guideline, but more in their face because they're going to get an email about it and because they have to read it. Well, they don't have to read it, but
yeah,
it's easy to miss the contributor.
Work. You could potentially do something like scan every single open issue in GitHub, like CodeTriage already does, and store in a separate database and say, like, is this the first issue you've ever opened? And like, and we're going to say, like, yes, we... Like, thank you very much. Here's how some things work. I guess you also do run the risk of, like, the contributor's guide on Rails is so long.
Right, but the reporting a bug is only a few paragraphs. That's a small subsection.
And maybe just, it's like, I think that for me, that would be, if I have a bug and it's really critical and I really want somebody to, like, help me look at it, it makes me feel better, like, if I get something automated that is like, hey, a bunch of people do this, and, like, this really helps, and it really helps us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, of course, I've not tried submitting something to Angular.
No, it's for them, it's you have to sign the CLA.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So they have there's a bot that responds with a checklist and then checks the stuff off automatically as you do it.
Wow, that...
And you have to submit the title of your pull request a certain way.
I, for one, embrace our robotic overlords. No, I mean, and it's not necessarily like that's a good or bad idea. Like what I wanted to do, it's just like I like to think of ways, like common things that prevent open source maintainers from doing more,
right?
And common frustrations in people who are contributing to open source, and mostly it's for the first time. Like a lot of people, it's like, might only ever open up one issue, and it's like, but please, that is very valuable.
Yeah. But also, please come back.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Like, people who submit multiple commits or multiple issues tend to be, in general, like, productivity increases exponentially over time, I think, as you get more familiar with the project.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Like, please do come back. We want you. I mean, we want you even if you're just going to come back once, but please come back more.
So, we've talked...
Be our friends.
So, like, codetriage.com, docsdoctor.com.
Org. It's pretty, yeah,
it's difficult
to say.
We'll link to those in the show notes. And those are, like, we're constantly talking about ways to get, like, new people involved, right? So that, like, brings new people to the table here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we talked with Aaron yesterday, and one of his concerns was, like, that's great, but we still need people that are, like, committed to larger things and have the time to do, like, gigantic things.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas on how to go about that? Like, he was talking about, like, getting more companies to sponsor open source. So you do a lot of open source work.
Yes. Yeah, so I like, kind of tricked my company into letting me do open source work. Don't let them know. Nobody let Heroku know that they currently sponsor me to do open source work. Well, okay, so this is, like, it sort of started serendipitously where I actually do this thing where I... once deployed a thing on Heroku on a Friday, and like a new feature on a Friday, and it totally ruined everything and made support like have to stay over the weekend, basically. I mean, and I had to stay over the weekend, and it was just bad, and I was like, we're never doing that again.
Yeah.
And then I'm just sitting there with this, you know, one day I was just sitting there with a feature in my hands on a Friday, and I'm like, oh, I really want to deploy this. And I was like, well, why don't I do something useful instead? And and so it's like...
Instead of deploying this thing that's a bug, I'll go do something useful.
Yeah, that's going to like break a bunch of people's apps. Like, like, you're welcome. You're all of you who use Heroku, you're welcome. So I started contributing to open source libraries and doing performance stuff. And this is like a plug for something that was also in my talk, but I call it like Fun Day, and now I'm now naming it and like asking other people to do it and calling it Fun Day Friday. Mm-hmm. And what actually ended up happening is my company, once they saw me contributing a little bit to open source, they said, oh, hey, these things are valuable, and would start coming to me and being like, hey, can you work on this thing in Rails? Some people who were doing an API in the, you know, over here were having this problem. Is that something that we can fix for everyone? Mm-hmm. Or this is something our customers are having. And I don't know that – I can't necessarily recommend that as a path to get more. And, you know, so I went from 20% open source time to, you know, I don't know how much I am at right now. It mm-hmm. kind of ebbs and flows each week. But that is one potential is to explicitly ask your company for it's like people, hey, guess what? You're getting bombarded with job offers. It's like in addition to negotiating salary, maybe you can also negotiate for some open source time, and it's like you will be a better developer and like your company will be a better company for it.
And you can even do like you mentioned, like they would come to you and be like, we're having this problem, can you like, so you can bring that the other way, right? And be like, you know, our developers keep hitting against like some difficulties in this particular part of Rails or this particular library.
Mm-hmm.
I want to fix this, but it's a mess and I'm gonna need like a week and a half.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Or like, I'm going to need some time, and like pitch them on a project, just like a project that you would do. Like, we've all probably pitched teams we've worked on like, we've got to slow down and refactor this part, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's not a feature, but I really want to do it. Like, that same type of pitching can possibly work for open source work.
Yeah, no, and I think that is actually pretty good, because ultimately, I don't know that there is a single path, but we need some full timers.
Yeah,
but we also
for sure.
We also can't expect an Aaron Patterson to enter the community that often.
Yeah, well, and they have to come from somewhere as well. You don't. I would say if you had just given me full time to work on Rails, you know, whatever, 3 years ago, I'd just be like, you know what, like, you know, now I've got a kind of a backlog of a bunch of stuff like I want to look into, and I have a pretty good idea of how to implement it. And like, it does take time to build up this base level of knowledge. ThoughtBot also has like a, what do you call it, like Maker's Day or something?
20%
investment
time.
Day.
Okay.
Investment day. So we have Fridays, but like, so that helps a lot. Like, we can do so much more than like, I feel very lucky to have that.
Yeah.
But there are like those things that you're just like, I can't do this every Friday for the next 3 weeks or the next 8 weeks or however it's long.
Yeah. There's definitely plenty of things that it's like, no, I need a solid uninterrupted week where it's like every day I wake up in the shower thinking about this thing. My shower time is a very important time.
But then there's also like, so adequate record,
mm-hmm.
the attributes API, like 3 years, 1 year, you know, like even just taking a week, mm-hmm. the amount of time it took to do the rewrites required for the attributes API. Like, if it was a week here and a week there, the context loss would have just made it impossible. I would have had to relearn so much every time I got into there. And there are the projects that just require months and months and months of full time.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one potential, and again, this is if I knew the answer, like
of course, no, we're just
Richard, tell us the answer, please.
The answer is 42.
What is 6 times 9?
But one potential idea is something that's really, really interesting to me is like, so Ruby Together just kind of popped up almost seemingly out of nowhere. Like, obviously I know Andre and like does amazing work, and like,
right.
If you're not familiar, Ruby Together is basically just like this organization that says like, hey, we want to make Ruby better and together, and they have some goals, and they're collecting money and then turning that around and sponsoring people to work on those certain goals.
Yeah.
So I actually think it would be interesting to have maybe either more organizations like that, or maybe even if Ruby Together became like with that kind of stuff, I feel like it's good to have a little bit of competition.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, even right now there's like Ruby Central, mm-hmm. and like they also sponsponsor things. So it's like, it's, you know, you've got
Isn't Ruby Central somehow involved with Ruby Together? I don't know.
The board overlaps 100%.
Okay, there you go.
I mean, not like there's other board members of Ruby Together, but I'm pretty sure all of the board members of Ruby Central are also board members of Ruby Together.
It's confusing, I don't know.
But yeah, like having more options like that, or having more companies involved in those things to sponsor more people.
Yeah, because
like,
I mean,
companies that make a lot of money off this and maybe don't want to dedicate an entire employee, but can be like, we'll throw some money in here. And then maybe they can like let one of their employees like go on an unpaid leave and take some of that money, or like contribute some of the money and like maybe take some from Ruby Together, or anything like that. Like all sorts of options we can consider.
But it's definitely a lot easier, I think, to get a bunch of companies who are saying, yeah, we'll pay for a week of open source.
Mm-hmm.
And then that all goes to, you know, a person, but then you get enough company, you know, you get 52 companies who can say, I can pay for 1 week, and then bada bing, bada boom, you have a full-time open source salary.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like I think it would be amazing if there's almost some sort of like a, like you do want to be really careful with what you incentivize.
Right.
But like in, I've seen a lot of companies be like, oh, I really want like this feature. And everybody else is like, yeah, we don't care. Why don't you build that? And they're like, but so it's like, we have money, but we don't have developers.
See, it's hard though. Cause if you turn it into that, then you get Rails Inc.
Yeah.
With Ruby Together, they're working on increasing the transparency. But the important thing is that you're paying for Andre, but you don't get to choose what Andre works on. Mm-hmm. You just get to choose whether you want to support what he is working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a distinction there, because we don't want. I mean, certainly there's always some corporate interest involved, but that can't be the biggest driving factor. And the full timers have a huge impact on the projects they're on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I concur.
Cool.
Problem solved.
Yeah. All right.
There you go. We fixed it.
we fixed open source.
What else? Do you have anything else you want to plug, or anything you're excited about?
Do you want to plug docsdoctor.org or codetriage.com again?
So I don't really think we have time to truly go into docsdoctor.org or codetriage.com. But if I was going to talk about docsdoctor.org or codetriage.com again, I think our listeners might
yeah, I guess our listeners are just going to have to go check it out for themselves.
Yeah, and yeah, if you don't get the joke, it's like when you're listening to a radio commercial and they repeat the same phone number like docsdoctor.org constantly. Or codetriage.com.
All right.
Oh, keep Ruby weird.
Oh, you guys are doing number two.
I'm not gonna. Am I announcing that?
Oh,
I run a conference called Keep Ruby Weird. We're probably most likely having another conference.
Are you gonna go with weirder? Is that a thing?
Keep Ruby weirder or weirderer? I don't know. We're working on it.
All right.
But stay tuned.
All right.
All right. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/24.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have any feedback on this episode or any other episode, you can tweet us at @bikeshed or email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm or leave any comments on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.